Today, public transit workers in New York went on strike because they were unable to reach suitable compromise with the MTA. But the strike, in fact, is illegal. In many places, public employees are forbidden from striking. Clearly, that doesn't always stop that from happening. We'll take your questions now on how public strikes work, the legality, the consequences, the history. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Nelson Lichtenstein is a professor of history and director of the Center for Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's with us by phone from his home in Santa Barbara, where I suspect it's a lot nicer than the 25 degrees that people are walking home in New York today.
Yes, it is, and I'm delighted to be on your show.
It's illegal for the transit union in New York to strike. They're doing it anyway, but at great cost to themselves.
That's right. Public employee strikes in the United States have always had a kind of quasi-legal character, and in many places they're outright illegal, but that doesn't prevent them from taking place. In fact, public employees have been among have been unionizing at a rate faster than others, and have been striking often, more so than other workers, for the last generation. When strikes may be illegal, but then so too is involuntary servitude. So Americans have the right to walk off the job. There are fines there, but the union believes that if it can basically secure its pensions, secure its future, then this will make a strike in the future unnecessary, perhaps for 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And the penalty in New York is 2 days' wages fined for every day on strike.
That's right. It's been that way for many years. It was in the 1960s and 70s, first teachers and then hospital workers were fined, they were arrested, spent time in jail. This didn't prevent the rise of very potent and important unions in those two fields, and they spread to many other parts of the country. So, yes, it makes it difficult, but I was reading the Times this morning, and it's clear that that many of the transit workers sort of understand the stakes involved and are willing, to, at least for the time being, to take some of those penalties.
Now, there, as you said, involuntary servitude is not legal either. Yet there is another alternative, the one that President Reagan took back in, 1981, when the PATCO, the air traffic controllers, went on strike, and he just fired them all.
Yeah, he did fire them. There were about only 11,000 across the whole country, and all of the time, many people thought that the air transit system would come to a halt. In fact, there were enough military and other people. He fired them. That's right. And it said it created a new context for unionism for the next 20 years, a much more difficult context. Whether or not in New York City that kind of strategy could be adopted by the mayor and the governor is problematic. New York City is, in fact, a pretty strong union town, and I think that the other unions and other politicians who work with the unions would probably object strenuously to such a dramatic move. I don't think that would happen.
You mentioned New York City, pretty much of a union town. That's true. Around the country, yet nevertheless, they have a law that prevents public employees from striking. Around the country, does it vary region to region, state by state?
Oh, very much so. In the South and the Mountain states, there are simply no laws or laws that that absolutely prevent not just strikes, but even collective bargaining, even sort of peaceful conversations between public employees and elected officials. In Virginia, where I used to live for a decade, there had been kind of informal negotiations between the teachers and some of the county administrators in Northern Virginia, and the state legislature passed a law prohibiting even talking. So it varies. However, the impulse on the part of workers in public employment to form some sort of an association, a union, is there, even in places like Texas and Georgia, et cetera.
Let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join us, by the way, it's 800-989-8255. This is Mary. Mary calling us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi. Gosh, I finally got through.
Ah.
You know, I'm just been a union member all my life, and I'm just wondering, what kind of leverage does a union have if they can't strike? I'll take my answer off the air.
Mary, thanks for your patience and appreciate the phone call.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. What recourse do they have if
they
can't strike?
Well, actually, I mean, of course, the strike is sort of an ultimate sort of threat. But in fact, strikes have declined rapidly and radically in the last generation. We don't have them. But among public employees in particular, once they organize, there's a lot of things they can sort of negotiate about and discuss at the at the local sort of office level without a threat of a strike. And then, of course, politics. In California, where I live, there was Schwarzenegger tried to reduce the capacity of unions to engage in politics in the last special election, and that was repulsed by not just unionists, but by the voting population in general. Mm-hmm. So politics is important. And in New York and other places, sometimes this has been quite efficacious. Many of the legislators in Albany, who ultimately control the subways of New York City, are so-called friends of labor, and whether or not they're willing to stick it to this union is another question.
Well, do unions, they do have other tactics they can use short of a strike, the rule book slowdown, sure. For example.
Yes. And public employees, at the post office, among police officers in particular, they would, call in sick or refuse to do overtime work.
The famous blue flu, yeah.
Right, that's right. Lots of things of that sort. The point is sort of when you get people together and they sort of are in a kind of institution together, there are lots of things they can do, which exercising a certain amount of influence, some of them more effective than others. That's one reason that in those regions of the country which are quite conservative, there is no mechanism whatsoever for public employees to even meet together. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of viewed as the first stage. Even if they just meet together, it's the first stage toward having a potent union movement.
Let's get another caller in. This is John from North Vernon, Indiana.
Yes, I'm a longtime trade unionist, East Coast liberal, I guess you'd call me.
In Indiana?
Well, I'm married and I'm living here in Indiana, yes.
Okay.
And I, at one point in time, did some work. I'm an attorney for AFSCME, mm-hmm. 20-odd years ago. And in Indiana, when Senator Bayh was governor, he exercised his executive privilege and granted collective bargaining to state employees within certain limits. And the very first thing that happened this past year with our current governor, his first act was to eliminate collective bargaining for state employees in the state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been Governor Mitch the Blade Daniels, who, of course, served his apprenticeship with the Office of Management and Budget in D.C.
I should translate another term. AFSCME is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, so all public employees.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they and the Teamsters had been the bargaining agents for the state employees for a number of years, and then the first act that our governor took this past year was just to eliminate that collective bargaining by fiat.
And Nelson Lichtenstein is what John is describing in Indiana. Is that a trend that's being seen elsewhere?
Well, yeah, the Republicans are very much very opposed to collective bargaining by public employees, and I think with Missouri and Indiana, newly elected Republicans rescinded executive orders that their Democratic predecessors had put in force. I should just mention, you mentioned the AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers. The most famous public employee strike in American history was an AFSCME strike, and it occurred in Memphis in 1968. It was the Memphis sanitation strike where Martin Luther King was assassinated. It was entirely illegal. There was no public bargaining law in Tennessee, but it points out an important thing about public employee strikes. If they are over an issue which is of sufficient importance and they have sufficient support, at least from one constituency, then they can succeed dramatically and really change the face of employment, and that's what happened in Memphis. That may or may not be on the cards in New York, but I would say this. It's very interesting to look at who's a member of the subway workers union there. They're immigrant workers, and insofar as we're having a kind of a civil rights movement for immigrant workers these days, this union to some extent represents it.
Now let's see if we can squeeze one more caller in. Michael calling us from San Francisco.
Yes, my comment is that when public employees strike, it really damages the arguments of those of us who believe in the provision of services through government. And more particularly when public transit workers strike, it really undermines the proponents of public transit. the public transit ends up having, in effect, a local monopoly, and the workers, the transit workers go on strike, and all of a sudden millions of people are without a means of getting to work.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, and let me ask you, Michael Nelson Lichtenstein, there's almost a special case when you're talking about fire and police.
Well, right, and they tend to, like policemen and firemen tend to strike, well, much less frequently. I should just say that the transit workers in New York don't strike on a dime. There were two strikes in the last 50 years, 1966 and 1980, so it's not like we have a lot of strikes. These happen once a generation, really, and it's about an important, you know, issues for the future. And then once a strike has taken place, and then you usually go many, many years without it happening. So it's not as if these things are happening all the time. Police, right? Police are considered very, very significant. And here, the precedent was set in 1919 by Calvin Coolidge, when he was governor of Massachusetts, who fired the Boston police.
Mm-hmm. But what about Michael's point that this undermines a confidence in public services?
Well, given the infrequency of strikes, and they are very infrequent. I mean, we're talking less than once a decade. I don't believe that's the case. I think the day-to-day inefficiency is far greater undermining of public services.
Michael, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Once a generation makes me feel old. Since the first New York City subway strike, I was in high school, and I covered the second one.
All right.
Nelson, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Nelson Lichtenstein is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Work, Labor, and Democracy at UC Santa Barbara, and joined us by phone from his home in Santa Barbara.